their strategy is just mirror imaging what Trump is doing. This is Trump's style. He always throws out maximalist demands, publicly tries to embarrass and humiliate the other side, and the Iranians are essentially mirror imaging his strategy. Ultimately, however, that is not how you get to a deal.
Okay, the U.S. has also threatened more strikes. Trita Parsi, in this last 30 seconds, where do you see this going this week? Is this, as in the U.S. population, the U.S. attacks on Iran are fiercely unpopular?
Yes, and Trump knows this, and he knows that his members of Congress from the Republican side are privately making more and more phone calls, complaining about this war, complaining about how it is destroying their chances in the November elections. Many of them are going to lose their seats as a result of this. Trump is under a lot of pressure, but he's still looking for a silver bullet that will make him a winner instead of engaging in serious diplomacy.
Trita Parsi, thanks so much for being with us, Executive Vice President of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. Thanks for joining us. That does it for today's show. A very happy birthday to Dennis Moynihan. I'm traveling to Toronto today to speak at the Radio Days North America Conference, then we'll appear at screenings of the new documentary about Democracy Now!, Steal This Story, Please. I will be Thursday night and Friday morning at the Main Cinema in Minneapolis, then in Chicago Friday night, and for two screenings on Saturday at the Music Box Theater and at the historic Oriental Theater in Milwaukee on Sunday. For information on all these screenings, and as well as our travel through the country, go to democracynow.org and stealthestory.org. I'm Amy Goodman in New York today. Thanks so much for joining us.
You're listening to 90.3 KFAI FM, Minneapolis, St. Paul, online and archived at kfai.org.
Good afternoon, and welcome to Mini Culture Presents. Thank you very much for being a KFAI listener and for tuning in to Mini Culture Presents. Today on Mini Culture Presents, we are pleased to present episode 4 of the Mini Culture Podcast. In this episode, the 4th of their 10th season. Crazy, I feel like I was just at the launch party for season 1 yesterday. They get so big so fast. But now, it's the 10th season. If you missed the first few episodes of the Mini Culture Podcast of not just this season, but you can catch up on all of them in your podcast feed when you just subscribe to the Mini Culture Podcast wherever you like to listen to your podcasts, MINNECULTURE, Mini Culture. And if you haven't already heard them, there are 9 other great seasons you can enjoy. But you can also find it all on their SoundCloud page, soundcloud.com/miniculture. And new episodes of season 10 are continuing to drop. Keep an eye and an ear out for that. In today's episode, we are going to visit the Mayday Cafe in Minneapolis and get a history of cooperatives in our fine state. Also, at the close of the show, we are going to hear a recent miniculture or 10,000 Fresh Voices stories about some great Minnesota arts things going on right now from Sheila Regan. Stick around for that. But for now, here is the Mini Culture Podcast, Season 10, Episode 4.
Welcome to the Mini Culture Podcast. I'm your host, Erica Janik. There's a cafe in South Minneapolis, rooted in coffee, pastries, and community. It's called Mayday Cafe, and last year its workers successfully transitioned the cafe to a worker-owned cooperative. The co-op model is new to Mayday, but it isn't new to Minneapolis, or even this neighborhood. Joseph Mogul tells the story of how the Mayday workers formed a co-op, its ties to the contentious co-op movement of the 1970s, and the even deeper history of cooperatives in Minnesota.
One frigid February morning, dozens of eager customers brave the Minnesota winter to wait in line outside a coffee shop. The occasion for this gathering? The Mayday Cafe, a staple of the South Minneapolis neighborhood, Powderhorn, was opening its doors for the first time under a new banner, a workers-owned cooperative.
So our reopening day, it was so cute. There had been two people who had come in the early morning hours to put up a banner out front that said now worker owned. Like there was a line out the door the whole day. A bunch of TV stations were there. My mom happened to be in town. So she was just in the corner crying. It was very cute.
That's Mira Klein, one of five worker owners at Mayday. Reopening day was the result of countless meetings, tireless fundraising, and leaping logistical hurdles. Despite uncertainty from coworkers and customers who feared the loss of their favorite neighborhood cafe, the workers did it. They bought the damn thing. Mayday's dedicated patrons cheered as they reopened their doors. A joyful occasion indeed, and one that's part of a little-known local history. It turns out, Mayday is the continuation of a long and often contentious co-op history in Minneapolis. In fact, Mira and the Mayday workers are not the first cooperative to exist in this exact storefront. But that co-op eventually floundered and went out of business 3 decades ago. So what's brewing for Mayday? And is owning your workplace really worth the tall order? My name is Joseph Mogul. I'm a regular at the Mayday Cafe, and I'm not the only one.
My name is Astrid.
My name is Jazzy.
My name is Samuel Babatunde Arrow Phillips.
My name's Lee Combs.
I'm Jeremy.
My name is Frank.
My name's Imogen.
And I love Mayday because it's been around for forever.
Because outside the cafe is a box of free, high-quality masks, which helps disabled and immunocompromised people participate in public life.
A space that's kind of rooted in the arts, for artists, for community.
I personally value the Mayday workers more than most, you know, most anyone.
You know, people take care of each other in a certain way.
There's the things that you meet up with friends.
They've got great food. Reasonably priced. They're just good people.
Well, it's small. It feels like a spot that is kind of out of the 90s. It has the feeling of walking in that it's been lived in and that there have been people coming for a long time. There's pictures of old customers on the wall who, you know, may have passed or who were regulars at some point.
That's Mira again. Before getting a job at Mayday, she worked at a neighborhood association in another South Minneapolis neighborhood called Phillips. In 2022, she was ready for something new. She left her job to work on a farm in Montana for the summer.
I grew up on the West Coast. I was feeling a need for like a reevaluation and connection to land and mountains. And it was actually on my drive back from Montana where I was like, you know what? I think that my ideal setup would be to work at a worker-owned coffee shop.
When Mira got back, she went looking for jobs at coffee shops. Neither of the two then existing worker-owned shops were hiring at the time.
But I did end up getting a job at Mayday, which felt like a really great community spot where I could just like feel connected to the neighborhood. The area feels defined by Powderhorn Park, and that is like a central green space, gathering space where I can go and run into a lot of people I know.
The Powderhorn neighborhood takes its name from the lake in Powderhorn Park. The lake used to be shaped like a powder horn, which is an old-timey container for gunpowder, generally made from a cow or buffalo horn. And Mayday Cafe is named after an annual event in the park. Every year on May 1st, or Mayday, people across Minneapolis gather in Powderhorn Park for the Mayday Parade. Community members make puppets, listen to music, and celebrate the 19th century labor movement that fought for the 8-hour workday.
Mayday feels like a sort of extension of the park in a way. You know, it's only a block away from the park. When there are big things happening in the park, there's always a lot of people in Mayday, either going before, going after, hanging out during.
Mira works front of house at Mayday. So on a busy day, like when something is happening at the park, she's balancing many different tasks.
So you're at the register, you're taking orders, you're making drinks, and then you're preparing all the hot food and gathering all the baked goods.
It was just another day on the job when the longtime owner of Mayday, Andy Lunning, turned to Mira and told her he was planning to sell the place. The Powderhorn community would initially react with shock and fear that their favorite neighborhood spot might soon shutter its doors. Even after the workers announced their plans to buy Mayday, some people were still concerned. Mira attributes part of this to dormant anxiety from folks who had encountered the challenges of the co-op movement of the past. But more on that later.
When it was announced publicly that the cafe was going to be up for sale, people freaked out. They were like, what am I going to do if this place isn't here anymore? Is it going to get torn down? Is it going to get turned into a Starbucks? Like, that's, nobody wants that.
Nobody wants that indeed. But Mira was unfazed. In fact, the idea of a worker-owned coffee shop had been percolating in her mind ever since her road trip back from Montana.
My co-barista turned to me and they were like, well, we should buy this place. It was like their first response. And that's also where my brain immediately went. Part of me felt determined from that moment to see this through.
Despite Mira's immediate conviction that this was the right choice, the journey from idea to reality would prove to be a tremendous feat.
From there, it was just a question of like organizing ourselves to have some conversations about it. And that was what proved to be a lot more difficult. The potential of owning a business together was just like a big leap from where we had all been relationally before.
So after Andy publicly announced he was going to sell, the bidding opened to the public. Anybody, any corporation, or a group of workers who could afford the place could buy it. It was time to kick things into gear and get organized. But it took over a month to coordinate an initial co-workers meeting where the idea to buy it was overwhelmingly supported. And that was just the first step.
We just didn't know enough. We ended up meeting with the owner just to get a little bit more information. I was reaching out to everybody who I knew who had connections to cooperatives. And there were a bunch of questions throughout those first few months about how much buy-in do we need to say that a group of people can continue to move forward? You know, like who is part of the group deciding? And that was like a really confusing back and forth spot for a long time.
While there were some initial yeses from Mira's coworkers, as things progressed, many people soon realized how big of a responsibility forming and owning a co-op would be. Being a worker owner at a co-op is a big deal. All the tasks of running a business that might normally be the job of an owner or manager is now your job. You have to be on top of finances and product logistics and training and scheduling and insurance, not to mention creating new drinks, baked goods, all while delivering excellent customer service. Each worker owner has a set of unique obligations. Before speaking to Mira, I thought that all of the workers were now also owners, but I was wrong. By the end of the co-op transition process, the only worker from the days of Andy's ownership who wanted to be an owner was Mira.
So about half the people who stayed wanted to also be owners?
So that's what was got kind of, and I guess this is just like transparent, what's going to go in this. That's what got complicated about this. So when we started out, there was a group of four of us who were workers who decided, yes, we want to be part of the transition team. There was a lot of buy-in from workers as a whole that, yes, this was a good idea. And, you know, please move ahead with doing this. We're excited about being in a workplace that's worker-owned, but we don't want to be worker owners. That's sort of what was happening a lot as we were trying to get the ball rolling all this. And it was a ton of unpaid work to make this possible. And not everyone is in a position to do that financially, time-wise, totally understandable. Then there was a subset of us, four of us, who were like, yes, we agree that we're going to be part of trying to make this happen. And of those four, I'm the only one who is now a worker owner. One person decided in the end to leave the cafe, and two other people decided, you know what, there's other things going on in my life right now. I don't actually have the time to take on worker ownership responsibility.
One of the biggest shifts of worker ownership is that there's nobody to shirk responsibility off to when things go wrong.
So, you know, for example, when a car crashes into the side of your building like it does last week, we had to shift our schedules.
A popular South Minneapolis cafe is open again after a car drove into it earlier this week. Here's what the damage looked like at the Mayday Cafe. No one was hurt, but the side of the building was smashed up, and inside things were knocked around and a wall needed repairs. It was a setback for the restaurant that just recently opened as a workers' co-op.
That was WCCO CBS Minnesota. And yes, that really did happen the week before Mira and I spoke. So several of Mira's coworkers who were initially interested in being owners changed their minds along the way. But Mira was steadfast, and despite her coworkers' hesitancy to join her as co-owners, they were still supportive. They wanted to work in a co-op, just not own one. Eventually, some new people were hired as bakers, and those new folks were interested in being owners. And so these four new workers would join Mira as worker owners and move forward with forming a co-op.
when I imagine like narratively perfect political transition, it's workers who were working there before and they're buying the business and they're going to be the ones who are worker owners. And I've had to like personally like wrestle with the fact that that's not what this looks like.
So this cohort of soon to be worker owners moved forward with their transition plans. It soon became clear that they were the only serious bidders to buy the cafe, and it was just a matter of raising the money. They took out loans from the city and from cooperative lenders. One big step would be fundraising $100,000 to help pay off these loans and for working capital to get started. And for that, the broader Powderhorn community, some of whom had at first been trepidatious about the future of Mayday, showed up in a big way.
We had people from the community who designed our merch, who designed our website, who helped run the fundraising campaign, who played music at our block party, who took pictures for us, and in general, like, told the story of Mayday to one another and helped spread the word.
Mira and her four co-worker owners had been bogged down in all the paperwork and finances and business licensing and general logistics of buying a coffee shop. So they decided to organize a block party, both to raise funds and to remind them of why they decided to buy Mayday in the first place, to continue serving the Powderhorn community, but this time with worker empowerment.
It felt really important to do something that was decidedly celebratory. And like, look, this is a huge deal. We're making it happen. The community is making this happen. Let's like come together and honor that and celebrate it and get hype for what this is going to be. Like inviting in the new instead of just being scared of the change. And my gosh, I mean, it was such a beautiful day. There was music, there were puppets, there was screen printing. Everyone was wearing their cute little t-shirts. We sold out of all our baked goods. It was just so much fun.
The block party was one more leap along a track strewn with logistical and financial hurdles. It also demonstrated just how much support the Mayday workers would get from the Powderhorn community during the transition. This support was instrumental in the workers' eventual success. They raised the money, jumped all the hurdles, and on January 29, 2025, signed a property deed. Mira and her four co-worker owners held the keys to the cafe. And where did Mira go to celebrate?
I went and I sat in the cafe alone and just sort of like looked around. I mean, I think that most people who have spent time in the cafe have never spent the time in the cafe by themselves. I think that's been a particularly moving experience. You know, when I have a moment to just sit and be in the space and look around and everything's really quiet, except for like the buzz of the espresso machine or a buzz of the oven or something like that. And I can just really feel like, oh my gosh, like I am one of the owners of this place.
Good? All right.
The co-op model was new to Mayday, but it wasn't new to Minneapolis, or even this neighborhood. Half a century ago, the very same storefront where Mira sat was home to the Powderhorn Food Community Cooperative. This co-op was part of the Minneapolis co-op movement of the 1970s, and one of many battlegrounds of the fabled co-op wars.
The co-ops really were a boiling mix of conflicting ideas.
Relationships were torn asunder. Friendships were shattered.
The city of Saigon just fell, you guys. Why are we fighting amongst each other?
That was audio from a 2021 documentary called The Co-op Wars, directed by Deacon Warner. During the 1970s, a group of young Minneapolis radicals, shaped by their anti-Vietnam War activism and general disillusionment with capitalism, adopted a new business structure for making and selling things, cooperatives. Here's how the makers of the Co-op Wars documentary define cooperatives.
Cooperatives are businesses that are owned and democratically governed by their customers, their workers, or both.
The first co-op to open in Minneapolis was called the North Country Co-op, and it was located in the West Bank neighborhood. They mostly sold fresh organic foods from local farmers, and they were a hit. Whether motivated by anti-capitalist politics or desire for healthy foods, people loved shopping at co-ops. The nation co-op movement caught fire. Within a few months, 12 grocery co-ops formed all around Minneapolis, including Powderhorn. In the mid-1970s, there were more co-ops in Minneapolis than anywhere else in the country. As the co-ops expanded, so did the scope of the political ideology underpinning the movement. Many in the movement sought a more deliberate approach for making political change. Inspired by Marxism, a faction of co-op organizers believed the co-ops could be an arena for mobilizing a working-class revolution. They called themselves the Co-op Organization, or the CO. Here's how the Co-op Wars film describes them.
The CO aspired to be a disciplined Marxist-Leninist antidote to the counterculture's anarchy and escapism.
Some dreamed of their local co-ops inspiring communist revolution. But others were in it for the community, for the love of food, and for the counterculture. They also viewed co-ops as an alternative to capitalism, but through a different lens than the CO. These folks were more aligned with anarchism and believed in change on a decentralized neighborhood level as opposed to through a militant central authority. Depending on who you ask, the divide was anarchists versus communists or hippies versus Stalinists. As both groups vied for control in shaping the future of the movement, co-op members took different sides. Some co-ops, including Powderhorn, were split.
Can you speak? Cindy! Woof! Come on, do it! Oh, you're not gonna know.
She has stage fright. That's Paula Gilbertson trying to get her dog, Zania, to show me a trick called speak. But it turns out Zania has stage fright. Paula loves co-ops. She's worked in co-ops her whole life. She's a member of 15 different co-ops. Today, she even works for a co-op of co-ops called the National Co-op Grocers Association. But it all started when she was living in Powderhorn as a teenager in the 1970s.
It was a very funky, eclectic neighborhood. We just all ran around in a big pack in the park.
Paula's parents were members of the Powderhorn Food Co-op, which at the time relied solely on volunteer labor.
My parents were raising five children on one salary and were very economical. So they joined the co-op and got the discount. And it was mostly driven by economics. But then that opened up this whole other world for me, which was this world of different kinds of food, right? Food that wasn't from the supermarket.
Paula fell in love with the co-op. She started volunteering at Powderhorn in junior high.
I gravitated towards the food and towards the people. The people were all super nice. There was a whole kind of community of people who lived communally, like on Park Avenue. And some of those people I met through the co-op.
Volunteering at the co-op as a teenager was an entry point to the counterculture that compelled many to the movement. It was less of a deliberate political project for Paula, though, and more of an enchanting community that she identified with and wanted to be a part of. The rift of the co-op wars, between the communists and the anarchists, was not a defining feature of Paula's time volunteering at the Powderhorn Food Co-op, but it did occasionally rear its head.
I read about how in 1976 there was a break-in. Were you there?
No, I wasn't there. I heard about it after the fact, and people explained it to me.
So, yeah. What was the story that you were told about that?
I was told that a group came in and tried to take over the co-op. They kind of forced their way in, and then some of the members who were opposed to that went and started handing the goods of the co-op out the side window.
At the time of the break-in, the CEO controlled the Powderhorn co-op, but the anarchists weren't happy about that. So they broke in, changed the locks, and installed a new cash register. This was the anarchist version of a flag planting. As the conflict ensued, the anarchists started shoving the store's products out a window. They believed the CO had undemocratically seized control of the co-op, and so they took action.
The group that took over was saying it was theirs, and the group that was kind of shoving stuff out the side window was saying, no, we paid for this, we work for this, this is ours, we're taking it. And so, you know, I knew there was a lot of strife about that.
This was not the only contentious moment of the co-op wars. Things even occasionally turned violent, as documented in Deacon Warner's Co-op Wars film.
They kicked in Chuck's door.
They mostly punched me in the body.
They had steel pipes and other weapons.
There was even a propaganda battle.
Partisans fought a war of ideas and recriminations through position papers, posters, and even comics.
We've agreed with many of the CO people on certain issues, but we are interested in alternatives to narrow-minded people exploiting macho, violent, and unprincipled tactics.
The paper two coordinators from Mill City wrote in response to the beanery workers' position paper reflects elitist, illusionary, and distorted views on social change.
Unbeknownst to most co-op movement organizers, the sectarian feuds of the co-op wars was an instance of history repeating itself. An earlier co-op movement, dating back to the early 1900s, laid the groundwork for the 1970s Minneapolis co-ops. And that history also led to conflict among co-op organizers. The story begins at the turn of the 20th century when mining and logging companies recruited 300,000 Finnish immigrants to work in the Iron Range of northern Minnesota. When the Finnish immigrants arrived in the Northlands, they found poor working conditions and squalid living quarters. So, in the tradition of Finnish socialism, they organized. Throughout the early 1900s, Finnish mine workers went on a series of strikes, demanding better pay and living conditions. The mining companies responded with all the usual tactics, including sending in scabs and deploying a private militia to break the strike. But one strike-breaking tactic was most effective. The mining companies convinced local merchants to stop selling goods to striking workers. All of a sudden, the Finnish workers were cut off from their source of food and other basic resources. They needed to build an alternative economy to provide these things for themselves. So, they responded by organizing co-ops, starting the first wave of Minnesota's co-op movement. By the peak of the first wave co-op movement in 1940, there were 118 co-ops in rural areas throughout northern Minnesota, Wisconsin, and Michigan. For decades, the co-ops achieved great success at providing autonomy for workers in the Northlands. But political questions, similar to ones later faced in the 1970s, would lead to sectarian divisions. Were the co-ops an instrument for communist revolution or simply a means for self-sufficiency? Should they be organized centrally by the Communist Party aligned with Stalinism, or decentralized and unaffiliated with a political party? In a pattern eerily similar to the 1970s co-op wars, two parties vying for control eventually splintered the co-ops. Most co-op organizers from the 70s weren't aware of their movement's lineage. However, some movement journalists who knew of this history sought to change that.
There's always things to learn because co-ops have a history of waves going up and down, up and down. And so it's important to try to learn, okay, what helps them last and sustain themselves. And the fact was, there are clear parallels with the struggle we were having with the communist sectarian group.
That's Dave Gutnecht, a journalist and activist. After a stint in federal prison for his Vietnam War draft resistance organizing, Dave got involved in the co-op movement.
I was involved in Mill City Foods, just down the street from Powderhorn Co-op.
Dave's most consistent role in the movement was editing various co-op publications, which he's done for over 50 years and still does today. The first of these publications was the Scoop Collective, a monthly regional co-op newspaper aligned with the anarchists.
The Scoop Collective was much more independently minded, cooperatively and anarchistically minded. We did not favor the co-op organization, so we became the vital source of news for the people who wanted, you know, democratically, cooperatively run organizations. And so that publication went from 1974 to about 1979, approximately.
In 1977, the Scoop Collective published an archive of the Finnish history called Origins and Legacies. They narrated the first wave Finnish co-op history, partly as a warning against the CO's tactics.
I believe people find it very instructive. I would say it was definitely new information for most readers. While there undoubtedly are strong connections, there is a certain myopia, if you know that word. Americans are amnesiac about history, and our generation was as bad as any in that regard, and we thought that everything was going to be new, including co-ops, even though we had this tremendous legacy.
The legacy of the Finnish co-ops actively shaped the 1970s movement. The fact that co-ops are even considered legal business entities in Minnesota can be traced to the early 1900s.
Thanks to our predecessors who persuaded their elected representatives in the Minnesota legislature to write and pass good cooperative law. So in Minnesota, we have very good law that supports all kinds of cooperative enterprise. Some states don't even have co-op law. They just put it under nonprofit or something.
The first co-op wave even influenced federal legislation. The 1922 Capper-Volstead Act, which was co-sponsored by Minnesota Representative Andrew Volstead, made agricultural co-ops exempt from antitrust laws. The connections between the two co-op eras get even more explicit. An attorney from the first wave movement named M.D. Zeddes worked directly with organizers from the 1970s. He helped them incorporate based on regulations he helped shape decades prior.
He helped devise a kind of hybrid worker cooperative incorporation structure because you got to be incorporated, right? You got to have some legally responsible people on and file with the state. And so he was very influential and knew all about co-op law. That was his entire background.
Even some physical sites from the Finnish era remained influential during the 1970s. One of these is Masaba Co-op Park, a member-owned campground that was a gathering spot during the Finnish co-op movement.
One other thing that still lives today in a great legacy of the previous generation was the Masaba Co-op Park, which is in northern Minnesota and was a retreat for the co-op leaders.
Despite all the imprints of the Finnish co-op legacy, most co-op organizers from the 1970s movement were oblivious to their lineage.
We didn't realize how much we could benefit from learning from the earlier generation.
You are listening to Mini Culture Presents here on KFEI. We are taking a momentary break from broadcasting episode 4 of the Mini Culture Podcast, season 10. We will return right after these messages.
Shashank Subramaniam and Abhishek Raghuram, two masters of the South Indian tradition, flute and voice, in concert Friday, May 15th, 7:30 p.m. at the Preeminent Concert Hall at Normandale Community College, 9700 France Avenue, Bloomington. For further information, go to imsom.org. Co-sponsored by the Indian Music Society of Minnesota and KFAI Radio, 90.3 FM Minneapolis, St. Paul, and on the web at kfai.org.
Support for KFAI comes from The Fine Line, presenting a joint show from artists Maye and Ambar Lucid, Sunday, May 10th. In this emotionally raw live experience, the duo wants you to feel the power of intimacy on stage. Between Maye's alternative soul and Ambar Lucid's psychedelic pop, the two defy expectations and genres. Tickets and more information about Maye and Ambar Lucid can be found at first-avenue.com.
You are tuned in to Mini Culture Presents, KFAI's sound and documentary showcase program. Today, we are airing episode 4 of the 10th season of the Mini Culture Podcast. Be sure to subscribe to the Mini Culture Podcast so you can enjoy all 9 other fantastic seasons of arts, culture, and history, stories about our great state, and catch new episodes as they become available. Support for this program comes from KFAI listener members just like yourself. So if you're able to help KFAI out financially, please do lend a hand. You are listening to Fresh Air Community Radio, KFAI 90.3 FM in Minneapolis and St. Paul, radio without boundaries. Support for Mini Culture is made possible by a grant from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. We now continue with the Mini Culture Podcast.
Back at the Powderhorn Co-op, Paula Gilbertson just loved being a part of co-ops, and she was pretty unbothered by all the conflict boiling over around her. So against the backdrop of the co-op wars, Paula dropped out of high school and got a job at a different bakery co-op while still volunteering at Powderhorn. The Powderhorn Co-op had a consumer ownership structure as opposed to the worker-owned structure at Mayday. This means that the consumers own the shop rather than the workers. Consumers in the neighborhood could become members, which entailed signing up for volunteer shifts. In return, they held decision-making power and got hefty discounts at the store.
At the end of the year in a consumer co-op, they say, well, we're going to set aside this much to reinvest in the co-op, but here's all this profit. We're going to give it back to our owners. And they're going to give it back to their owners, not based on how many shares they bought, because everybody only buys one share. They're going to give it to everybody based on how much they patronize the co-op, how much they shop there. So if you shopped at the co-op a lot, you know, you're going to get a little bit bigger patronage refund.
Members could also join the co-op board, which is where big picture decisions were made. Dave told me that this consumer patronage structure was rooted in the early 1900s Finnish movement, as was the emphasis on having a manager to help run co-ops. For years, the co-op operated with solely volunteer labor, but that would soon change, and Paula would get an opportunity to focus more of her capacity at Powderhorn.
The co-op had what they called an afternoon coordinator position, and it was like some of the first paid positions beyond volunteers. And the person I live with was like, yeah, I don't know if I want to commit to like 25 hours a week. That seems like a lot. Now I look back at it and I'm like, ha, ha, ha. So we split the position. And then we convinced the person who was the coordinator to hire the two of us.
That was in 1979. By the end of the 70s, some of the other Minneapolis co-ops shuttered their doors due to political and economic factors. This was a period of national economic hardship, which would soon turn into a global recession. Simultaneously, the co-op wars conflict was starting to hurt business at some co-ops. But Paula says the Powderhorn co-op was growing faster than ever. However, relying solely on volunteer staff was precarious and made the store a little bit too hectic, especially as business continued to grow. The board came to a vote during their annual meeting and decided to hire their first ever paid staff. They hoped this would usher in a more reliable system. And that's when Paula stepped in as store coordinator.
I loved being a storekeeper. So we would do things like receive orders, and the farmer would come in with her eggs, and, you know, we'd buy eggs, and you'd run the store, and you'd help coordinate the volunteers.
When Paula told me about her time as a storekeeper, I was a bit confused, because the hierarchy seemed antithetical to the idea of a cooperative. But this confusion was based on a misconception. Co-ops don't mean no structure. Instead, they allow for a structure that is democratically chosen by the people who shop or work there, rather than one that aims to maximize profits for shareholders. So, the board of Powderhorn, which was made up of consumer members, decided that things had to change. And this change was met with mixed feelings.
As the co-op became a little bit more structured, there was sort of a love-hate with going towards employees. My impression was it was met with relief and also a little bit of sadness.
On the one hand, people were sad to see the end of the hodgepodge volunteer model. The store lost some of its DIY feel, but as paid workers, including Paula, came in, things became a little more reliable. It was still a consumer-owned co-op, and it still had a strong neighborhood engagement. Paula eventually became general manager, and things ran pretty smoothly for about a decade.
I think people were happy to have a functioning store in their neighborhood. We went from having these weird reach-in coolers to actually have a walk-in, a little bit more pleasant of a shopping experience and a little bit more of a full-service shop. And it was still pretty small and funky, and it still had that little smell when you walked in that smelled like a co-op.
But in 1989, 10 years after coming on as paid staff, Paula left for the East Coast to work at a co-op in Boston. And that's when things started to go downhill.
When I left to go to Boston, they hired someone to be the general manager after that. And I think that person, having not come from the culture, I think he got some backlash. Mm-hmm. I think he rubbed some people the wrong way. And I think he was kind of seen as an outsider. And I think that that exacerbated some feelings people had. He had more standard conventional business leanings. And from what I hear is that was met with some resistance and frustration.
This new manager was not grounded in the Powderhorn community the way Paula was. As a result, the neighborhood support for the co-op slowly dwindled. Business was not booming. And in 1992, the board voted to move back to the volunteer-based structure. They hoped this would reignite community engagement and save the co-op. Coincidentally, Paula had just moved back to Powderhorn.
I came back to town in 92. And actually ended up getting another job in food, but I lived in the neighborhood.
Even with the changes the board made to keep the co-op going, things were rough. Between the lack of community support in the early 90s under new leadership, road construction in front of the store, and multiple break-ins, the co-op's days were numbered. Sensing the end was near, Paula even stopped by to see if she could help.
I went in and I, you know, hey, I used to work here. You want any help? Blah, blah, blah. And they were not very friendly. I think at that point, maybe they were stressed out. You could see they were struggling. And I think maybe it was past repair at that point.
In December 1994, the Powderhorn Food Community Co-op closed its doors.
I was really, really sad. That was a very sad day. Mm-hmm. Saw a lot of people coming to say goodbye that day, you know? And a lot of people put a lot of blood, sweat, and tears into it.
But the space of the former Powderhorn Food Co-op didn't stay empty for long. After a brief stint as a hardware store, the Mayday Cafe opened a few years later. It wasn't a co-op yet, but it quickly became a neighborhood favorite, rooted in coffee, pastries, and community.
A mainstay in the heart of the Powderhorn neighborhood in South Minneapolis is back in business. After being closed for a couple of weeks, the Mayday Cafe reopened as a worker-owned cooperative this morning. Maury Glover shows us why this is a new era for the go-to gathering place.
That's news footage from Fox 9 KMSP. After intense conversations among workers, raising $100,000, and working through heaps of paperwork, the Mayday Cafe reopened as a worker-owned co-op. But, as the history of the Powderhorn Food Co-op shows, running a cooperative is complicated. It's one thing to believe in a project, but it's another to actually make it successful. If one person knows this, it's Mayday worker owner Mira Klein.
And I've also had to give so much from myself and my life, and I have more perspective now on what it tangibly means in a day-to-day way to be in deep in this type of autonomous, self-determined project. And it's so hard. It's so hard. It is. I thought it was going to be hard, and it is so much harder than I ever thought it was going to be.
Like some of her political forebearers in the co-op movements of the past, this was always a political project for Mira. In fact, she was inspired directly by the historic 1970s movement.
I have taken a lot of inspiration from a flyer that a friend showed me from like a 1970-something Minneapolis worker co-op assembly, when there were just many, many dozens, if not hundreds of worker co-ops on that list. And there was a like organizing body to organize those worker cooperatives. And I know, you know, as shown in the co-op wars, of course it's complicated, but I felt really inspired by that kind of organization and what it looks like to really have an economy of worker cooperatives deeply in relationship and supporting one another. I feel inspired by the history and that lineage, and I think that's something that this, you know, smaller group of us is trying to build out over time.
I asked Mira how her political organizing background factored into her vision for the Mayday Co-op.
To me, being part of this cooperative transition has always inherently been a political project. And I have had to remember that it is also people's jobs. And that's what is so exciting about this, is like political transformation in the workplace, where through like autonomy and self-determination, we can also be part of like a political process of building a world that I want to see more. But I've had to remember that in conversations with people about the sort of day-to-day sort of tangibles of what it means to work in a worker cooperative, leading with high-level values doesn't resonate. What resonates is like, how much am I going to get paid? What are my responsibilities going to be? Is the inventory actually going to come in on time so I can do my job?
Perhaps Mira's conviction to the co-op transition as a labor organizing project explains why she was the only previous Mayday worker willing to take on the risk of worker ownership. And despite these risks, there were immediate tangible benefits to the democratic decision-making processes of working in a co-op.
Have there been like moments of victory where like you were able to do things that wouldn't have been possible without a cooperative model?
Yeah, I mean, a huge example is that we have gotten to make decisions for ourselves about how much we want to pay ourselves and our coworkers. So we just got to decide to give ourselves and everyone a $2 an hour raise. That's pretty great.
Pretty great indeed. Beyond the raise, the Mayday workers also have autonomy to organize community events.
I'm personally really excited about having like political education happening in the cafe about cooperatives more, and having it be a gathering space for other worker co-ops. That's something that I'm really invested in. I know there are others who are really excited about doing like high school art shows or having events in the evening so that the space can continue to operate as a community space in the neighborhood even after, you know, we're done selling baked goods for the day.
Forming a co-op gave the workers agency to shape Mayday however they see fit. But the onus of accountability to customers now also falls solely on them.
As one of the worker owners, I've opened myself up to more like feedback and people's ideas. And so some of the people who really care about it, who now have my phone number, are like texting me to say, hey, just want you to know that, you know, my coffee tasted a little bit off today. And then I respond and I say, oh my gosh, thanks so much for letting me know. I'll comp you a coffee next time. And then, you know, this person comes in and we chat for a while. And I, you know, I'm like, how's the coffee today? And so there's like a depth and intimacy of relationship because this place matters so much to people. And I know that they're giving feedback out of love. And I want to respond to it out of love too. And they care about this place so much. So yesterday I had like a 20-minute conversation with someone on shift after being like, tell me about how your coffee tastes today. And I genuinely, there's like a sincerity to wanting to hear what people have to say, and people have a lot to say.
For anybody who has worked a service job, customer service can be a deeply alienating experience. Despite doing the work to keep a business running, you're probably underpaid and overworked. You often don't have any say in how your workplace is governed, and meanwhile, your boss likely insists that you put on a smile for customers. Frankly, workers are often not treated fully human. And while still sometimes tricky, when you're actually the owner of your workplace, have a voice in the way it's run, and a stake in its success, the sense of alienation is diminished. Perhaps this agency is what enticed both Paula and Dave to living a life working at and with co-ops. Maybe the empowerment of not having a boss can help explain the passion of so many during the co-op wars. Owning your workplace does not just transform the business, but it has the ability to transform you. And that is something worth celebrating.
In this country where there is like so much emphasis on individualism, there is so much deep personal and interpersonal learning that each of us who are part of this Mayday project are having to do in order to make it go. And I just keep coming back to like, damn, we have so much work to do to make this possible on a bigger scale. And I really believe in it on a bigger scale. And I believe it's both possible and I believe it's necessary. But holy shit, like, this is going to be really hard. Like, this is just a cafe.
So we've talked about some of the challenges and the things that are exciting about working at a place that you own. Is it worth it? What's your response to, is it worth it?
Yes, it's worth it. I really enjoy being at work. Even though my life feels absolutely chaotic and so hard, actually one of the best things about it right now is being in the cafe. I feel a sense of like purpose and ease and calm when I'm there. It like lifts my spirit, and I feel a sense of belonging and connection. It's when I get home that I'm like, oh my God, I've got so much to do. This business doesn't exist without the neighborhood that holds it. When things get hard, just sitting in the cafe and taking in the ambiance of how happy people are to be there and how glad people are that this place is open. And you know what? I think that this is going to be a really successful business. And if it fails next year, like, we had a year of providing, like, Mayday still exists. It's still a place people can come. It's still a place people can be with one another. And there are many, many people there every day. And it will have been a year of people getting to be together. And I really think we're going to last longer than that. And yeah, that feels totally worth it to me.
I'm Joseph Mogul for KFAI Miniculture. Enjoy the Mayday Anthem by Minneapolis folk band Two Old Cat.
Well, the Mayday Cafe is a place that's gonna stay. Been around for about 2 decades with many more to come.
You've been listening to Miniculture on KFAI. Support for Miniculture is provided by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. For more stories like this, check out the Miniculture tab on kfai.org.
From the building to the mops, that means they'll keep running it and they'll own it. And they'll get to decide how to run it from inside. And we'll all get to keep enjoying they provide. From a first date to a 100th date to a business meeting, you walk in the door and this whole place just feels like a friendly greeting. You know you're in the right place when you smell whatever's baking. You'll find a table and enjoy yourself, and there is no mistaking. Did you hear the workers are buying the shop? From the building to the mops, that means they'll keep running it and they'll own it. And they'll get to decide how to run it from inside. And they'll all get to keep enjoying the magic they provide. Yeah, we'll all get to keep enjoying the magic they provide.
You're listening. listening to 10,000 Fresh Voices, a project of Miniculture. I'm your host, Erica Janik. What happens when you add electric guitar, high-energy vocals, and upbeat percussion to your ballet? For ballet companies, they hope it adds up to a lot more people in the audience. An outgrowth of rock operas, rock ballets are reimagining the art form for a modern age. KFAI's Sheila Regan has the story.
The audience that showed up to the Fitzgerald Theater for the Twin Cities Ballet's production of Romeo and Juliet were ready to rock. Rock ballets are trending as a way to attract new audiences to a classic form. At the Fitzgerald Theater, Teresa Tucker was a repeat customer, but she doesn't consider herself a typical ballet fan.
Just what is rock ballet?
Tucker got turned on to the show by her daughter and has come to see it 2 years in a row because she loves the music of the band Queen.
It's the music, it's the energy. It's just so fun to see the dancers and the music. It's the choreography. It's amazing.
Kelly Tucker, a preschool teacher, learned about the show from a Facebook ad. She thinks the rock music really adds to the ballet watching experience.
Ballet is, it's fine. Like, I went to school for performing arts. I've seen ballet. But the fact that it's the music of Queen and Romeo and Juliet, which is such a classic story, I think it's going to be awesome.
Artistic directors Denise and Rick Vogt had been planning on producing a rock ballet for decades, first taking on short scenes when they were young dancers together living in Germany.
But we had done different small pieces, you know, a 15-minute piece or a single movement to, you know, Prince, Frankie Goes to Hollywood, sometimes with a band, sometimes not.
Later, they'd move to Minnesota and grow their company to the point where they felt they had the capacity for a full rock ballet.
We needed a company not to hire in as a quick project because we didn't have that kind of funding, but dancers who were there that we could choreograph on and build out the story.
In 2018, they presented Pink Floyd's The Wall for the first time at the Kohl Center in Minneapolis.
A lot of people were just fascinated by that whole idea. They said, oh, how can you do a ballet to Pink Floyd, to rock music? I'm like, how can you not? It's all music, you know, and it tells a story. It has movement and emotion and feeling. And The Wall is a much deeper story than most people realize.
The audience loved it.
There were people who had never been to ballet before.
For the Vogts, rock music lends itself to their company's mission to make ballet accessible, relatable, and fun.
We were facing issues where people were thinking ballet wasn't relevant. They felt it was elitist, not approachable. They couldn't relate to it. So we try to do stories that people can relate to using music they can understand and relate to in a way that also fulfills our artistic yearnings and expression and the dancers. Give them something that they are proud to do and love to do and can really sink their teeth into.
These days, rock ballets are growing in popularity. Take Birmingham Royal Ballet's Black Sabbath the Ballet as an international example. Here in Minnesota, Collide Theatrical Dance Company has a dance version of Romeo and Juliet set to pop in rock music that they last performed in 2025.
There's four different Romeo and Juliets last year, all completely different. There's two Queen rock ballets this year. They're going to be completely different because when you get to that level of popularity, you know, there's original variations of things and finances have a part of it.
Meanwhile, Ballet Collaboratory has a ballet set to the music of Queen called Freddie Break Free. It takes on the story of Queen's lead singer, Freddie Mercury. In the show, Freddie is played by two people, a dancer and singer Alex Parsons of the cover band Crown Jewels.
Empty spaces, what are we living for?
Parsons was a big fan of rock operas as a kid.
You were actually telling a story with rock and roll. That idea of that complete album and making everything, every one of your senses as you're getting into this, you're really engulfing yourself into this whole story.
Someone's gonna...
Zoe Henro, Ballet Collaboratory's artistic director, said she began talking about the potential project almost 10 years ago with the company's executive director. They wanted to figure out how to get people out of their comfort zones.
Dance audiences are dwindling. From national surveys that Dance USA has been taking. They did a big study over the last 10 years, and it used to be that you would have one audience member that would come at least to one show every season. Now they're seeing that same audience member is coming to a show every three seasons.
That stark data means producers need to get out of their boxes too, Henro said.
If this art form is going to really become an art form for everyone, that we need to break out a little bit more. And we do that by creating rock ballets. You know, I think that when people go to see live music, they want to dance. They want to throw their hands up. They, you know, they want to do a shimmy. So allowing that kind of like natural social dance, spice of life type of movement also come out in the choreography.
Rock ballet is still ballet. There are beautiful lines and elegant shapes. It's just got a boost of rock and roll to liven things up a bit. And producers are hoping it brings audiences back to the theater. For KFAI, I'm Sheila Regan.
And this has been Miniculture Presents here on KFEI. My name is Michael Whetstone, and there we heard another new episode from Season 10 of the award-winning Miniculture Podcast at the top of the show. Check your podcast feeds for more episodes to come right around the corner. If you would like to help keep these very vital and hyper-local Minnesota-centric stories on the air, consider making a pledge today to Miniculture's Radio Home. KFEI relies on your financial support. Real community, truly people-powered public radio. Please make a difference and a donation today at KFEI.org. Thank you. You are listening to Fresh Air Community Radio, KFEI 90.3 FM in Minneapolis and St. Paul. Radio Without Boundaries. Support for this program comes from KFEI listener members. Support for Miniculture is made possible by a grant from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Thanks again for tuning in. Stick around for the Upside Down.